Hey everyone, this is Mahesh. I am here with Jacob Little and Kevin Smith. This is the Ampere Amplified podcast, and this is kind of a special podcast because we're all in three different locations. I'm here in Portland, Jacob is in Raleigh, and Kevin is in Santa Clara, and so we're doing this remotely. Today, we have two folks from the compiler team and software team coming together to chat. Jacob is one of our interns this summer and fall in the software team and firmware team in Raleigh. Hi, Jacob.
Hey.
And Kevin Smith is our senior director of compiler technology. He's wrangling the software from the standpoint of keeping the compiler alive and up to date with regards to how we can tune software that gets run on our new hardware. So welcome, Kevin.
Thank you.
And this podcast is a continuing series of episodes where we pair our interns along with senior leader and have them chat because you never know what mentorship stories can come out of that. So I'm really excited to see and hear what we have in store. So I'm going to let Jake take it away and see where it goes.
Yeah, so I guess the first thing, you know, this is more of an interview from me to you, Kevin, is I guess we should kind of start with some context about what it is that you do at Ampere, how you would describe that, and why what you do is so important to what Ampere is doing.
Well, I work on compilers, and compilers are important because programmers write programs in C, or Fortran or some other language. But for it to actually run on our hardware, somebody's got to translate that high-level programming language into binary code, ones and zeros that the processor can execute. Now, the interesting thing about compilers is that for any given source code, there's probably hundreds, if not thousands, of ways to generate the binary code that's correct. But of those hundreds or thousands, there's probably a few of them that perform much better than the others. And my job is figuring out how to get those that perform so much better than the others on Ampere hardware. And in doing that, it really helps our competitive advantage. If we just let, you know, crappy code get out there that wasn't really well optimized, everyone would think our processors weren't that good. So it really is, you know, bringing out the best of our processors by targeting Ampere-specific technologies.
And I know one of the things that Kevin and I collaborate on is understanding which instructions are, let's say, tuned better for a particular microarchitecture. And so if there's like a floating point add that we decide to make a lot faster in our next silicon, then we tell that to Kevin and his compiler team, and then they make sure that that choice of instruction is used more prominently than perhaps the other one, which might have been slower.
That's a good example. And even if we made something, you know, super fast, like a floating point instruction, we'd find out ways to use it that we weren't using before. Like, you know, maybe if we had an integer add, maybe if the floating point were super fast, we'd move it over the floating point unit. So it's that kind of processor specific tuning. A lot of things about, you know, how the cache is laid out, how big it is, how wide it is, everything else are very tunable from the compiler.
So I guess that kind of goes into a good question that I think a lot of people have when we first start talking about compilers is like, what is that intersection between hardware and software? Because effectively, you know, that's what's happening, right? Is you're writing high-level software, you're breaking it down into something a computer can read. So what is it like for you? What level of understanding do you need to have of the underlying architecture to generate good compiler results?
Yeah, it's really a combination of, you know, understanding programming languages, you know, what the semantics are, various constructs, what the rules of the language are, and you really do need an in-depth knowledge of the computer architecture also. So, this is kind of a fun job because it's a little bit architecture, a little bit soft, a little bit magic.
Yeah, that sounds that does sound like it would be incredibly interesting. You're the lead right now for compilers. I assume nowadays now mostly what you do is more of a managerial position in that regard, or do you still do a lot of the technical work yourself?
You know, throughout my career, I've done it all probably. You know, I started out being a programmer. Oh yeah, this is fun. They're letting me program it, they're paying me for it. And eventually they said, why don't you be a project leader and help these other people at the same time? And then eventually I became a manager. And when I became a manager, I was still actually writing some code because I didn't realize that I had a new job. I thought I still had my old job. But I wasn't able to focus on the programming. And pretty soon my team came to me and said, you can't check in and anything anymore. You're making too many mistakes. You really do need to be able to focus to program. And I was doing a little bit of programming, a little bit of managing, too much multitasking, and nothing was working. So I was a pretty crappy manager and a pretty crappy programmer. So I had to do something about it. And I focused on being a manager and learning how to delegate things. And, you know, eventually, you know, I became a manager of managers. We had a pretty big compiler team. I got to do new things that I didn't do before that were still interesting and challenging. So I wasn't writing code so much, but I got to think about what is our strategy? How can we maximize the benefit to the corporation? So, you know, having a compiler is one thing, but are there certain things you can do that maximize the value to the company? And right now at Ampere, one of the things that's maximizing value to the company is getting really good SecGrate 2017 integer scores. And that's an industry benchmark where you can compare our processor with others. And we're trying to put Ampere in the best light. So strategically, that's really important. SpecInt is kind of used as the door opener. You have to have a good number before they, you know, talk about, you know, what they're really going to be using our processors for. Anyway, so yeah, I've been manager, been director, been lots of things. My job right now is kind of interesting because my team's pretty small. We probably have the world's most impactful tiny team on compilers. You know, part of it's managing, but a lot of it is I'm very technically involved again also. I love reading assembly language, you know, and it's, you know, it's kind of like the challenge is to look at something in assembly and figure out exactly how that came from the source code. What was the compiler doing? Could it have done it any better, in a different way, faster, whatever. So, I guess I'm very technical still also.
I guess that's a good question, because you've probably worked with a lot of different assembly languages over the course of your career, haven't you?
Yeah, you know one, you know them all.
So you don't feel like that transition from maybe x86 to ARM was much of a like roadblock for you?
No. The only thing is I sometimes get confused if the result register is first or last, and then I have to look at a store instruction and a load instruction and figure it out.
Yeah, I think that's a universal issue.
It's just like USB, right? You try to plug it in and, oh, that's the wrong way. And so you turn it around, you try to plug it in and you're like, oh, wait, the first way was the right way.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm glad that you brought up that you remain technical, because I was going to say that you haven't become like a pointy-haired boss in any way. You've been put into a position of setting the vision for what kind of optimizations you want to attack in the compiler and trying to tie the hardware and the software together. You know, going back to Jake's question, is like understanding the microarchitecture of the CPU and trying to implement those changes in the compiler. And you've kind of captured a lot of that.
I try hard. And as for being a pointy-haired boss, so I love reading Dilbert. It's good instructions about what not to do. On the other hand, I always thought the best managers were the ones that actually came up from the group rather than coming from an outside. So yeah, there's management skills that are universal, but there's nothing like really understanding what the people who are working for you are actually doing. So I'm a big believer in promoting from within. I mean, sometimes that's not practical, but whenever you can, that's the best way.
Yeah, I have a story about our CTO, Atik. So Atik is leading our architecture team. And many, many years ago at a different company, I was looking around in the source code of the simulator that we were writing and using the annotate and the logging functions to see who wrote what code. And if you step back way back into the history, I found some code that had been written by Atik. And he came by one day and I'm like, hey, look, I found your stuff. And then he started laughing. He's like, yeah, don't look there. There's a lot of bugs in that code. But that helped me realize empirically that my boss was literally in my shoes many years ago. And so he knows what I'm doing and what I'm going through because he has experienced that himself. And I think that's very important.
I had the same thing. I remember one day somebody came up to me and said, you know, years later when I was a manager, I deleted the last line of your code that was still active. And they're very proud of that.
That's awesome.
So yeah, I guess now would probably be a good time to talk. So, you know, we've been talking a little bit about what you do now, but I think it'd be interesting to talk about how you got here. How did you start working in computing? And then what was your experience like kind of moving up to where you are now at Ampere?
Yeah, it was a very enjoyable journey. So, you know, I graduated from college. I got my first job. Don't know how, but somebody picked me and I went there and I said, what do I get to do? And they said, well, you get a program. And I said, are you going to pay me? And they said, well, yeah. So everything was good. And I started working and I was in a testing group. So other people were writing code and I just had to do a final test to make sure it worked. And that, you know, was interesting for a couple of months. And then it was kind of like, well, you know, I kind of want to write code myself. So one time I found a bug in the code I was testing and I went and looked at it and figured out how to fix it. And I said, hey, I found a bug and I fixed it. And, you know, eventually they let me fix more things. And pretty soon I was also asked to develop code. So that was kind of cool. And then, as I said earlier, you know, I was coding myself and apparently doing a good job. I had a good attitude, good work habits. You know, I'd come in, I'd, you know, stay the whole day, I'd stay longer. You know, I really liked programming. So it was something I loved to do. I was good at it. And they needed me to be a programmer. So, you know, everything was all aligned. And eventually they said, hey, we need you to, you know, kind of organize the work of your peers. And they made me a project leader. And that, you know, went pretty well. You know, I was respected within the team. So they didn't, you know, give me too much grief when I was telling them what to do. But then, you know, I learned how to tell other people what to do also. And the big learning was you don't tell them what to do. You pose a problem to them and ask them how they'd solve it. And that worked a lot better than telling people what to do. And I was successful at that. And, you know, then they said, well, you know, we really need you to be a manager. And I really was a poor manager when I started because I really didn't rock what a manager was, that your output is what your team does, not what you do. You know, going from individual to manager is totally different. Your output isn't, you know, how hard you work and what you can do, even if you can do twice as much as everybody else or three times as much as everybody else. When you're leading a whole team, you're impacting 10 times what any person can do. And, you know, so your impact goes up, but then for your impact to go up, you have to really develop your influencing skills also. How do you get other people to do something? And, you know, telling them what to do, commanding, ordering is probably the least effective way of motivating other people. So, you know, really figuring out individuals, how they best work, what they like to do, and giving them the stuff they like to do as opposed, you know. But then, you know, the problem with it is there's always something that no one wants to do.
Yep. Yeah.
And those were always hard because I usually did them myself, even though I hated doing them. And my philosophy at my job is to not do things I hate to do. Mm-hmm. So in general, I try to, you know, if there's something I really don't like to do, I try to delegate it to someone else that if I can find someone who likes to do that. But if all else fails, you figure out how to do it as quickly as possible and not spend any time on it at all. I write very fast status reports. Anyway, so my career went on. You know, I was involved. I was always asking and prompting people and figuring out, you know, what my team is actually working on. You know, as I got higher up, I was not as involved in the details, but I always wanted to know what was going on, who was doing what, who the superstars are, you know, going around talking to people, occasionally finding out that people were doing something they really shouldn't be doing. And that was important. You're responsible for your whole team, and you really need to know what's going on. And, you know, there's times when not everyone is strategically aligned, and you have to find those things out. Anyways, then I came to Ampere, and we're a startup, and there was no compiler team, and I had to start from scratch, and there's so much to do because, you know, the generated code for our processors wasn't as good as it could be. So rolled up my sleeves, got a team, made some really good progress.
How important do you think it is to understand the big picture of what your team is doing as you interact with your adjacent collaborators and the architecture team and strategy overall? Like, how important is it to, one, know about it and also to, like, share that vision with your team?
Ooh, you threw me off on the word team. So team is kind of interesting. What is your team when you're a manager? You know, your team really isn't the people that report to you. Your team is your peers. And that's kind of something you also have to grok when you become a manager. That your job is to work across the organization, not just with the people below you. You have to work up, you have to work sideways, you have to communicate, you have to make sure the people you're communicating with understand what you're communicating. So when I'm talking to the engineers reporting to me, I talk one way, very technical, and then I have to absolutely up-level it if I'm going to talk to my manager or, and oftentimes, even my peers.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that technical communication skills is probably the most important aspect because the technical problems can be solved. You know, we're all smart engineers, but sharing what you've done and sharing the importance of what you've done and understanding what the next problems are, that all cuts across like your peers and your upper management as well. And telling them what's happening, I think, is like really important, and having the voice to do it. And I think it takes time to cultivate that voice.
It's really important. If people don't know what you're doing and why it's important, over time, your group's going to go away. Nobody else is going to figure out why your group's important. You have to tell them why your group's important.
I was going to say there's so many aspects to technical communication too, because it's like you talked about going up, down, sideways, right? You know, there's technical communication in layman's terms. There's technical communication in like very like concrete technical terms. And then there's kind of like somewhere in between where you're talking with people who kind of know what you do, but don't know exactly what you do. It can be difficult to navigate all of those. And I feel like the extremes are probably the most difficult, you know, where you're trying to communicate up to someone who really has very little idea what your work looks like. And then sometimes for someone like you who's been in the industry for a while, I assume you've probably gotten pretty good at explaining very hyper-technical concepts to people. But sometimes, you know, at least someone, you know, starting out myself, I've actually had a lot of difficulty in the past trying to explain something that I understand technically very in depth, but I have a really hard time getting that point across to someone else, because it's something that I took me a long time to understand and conceptualize. And maybe I don't even understand exactly how I conceptualize that and how to give that to someone else.
Yeah, that really is a challenge, making sure that other people can understand the concepts you're trying to get across. I always, you know, before I give a presentation, or even a lot of times on one-on-ones when there's something specific I want to talk about, I spend some time up front thinking about my audience. How much of what I want to say will they be able to understand? What size pieces do I need to give them? The worst thing in the world is going to a presentation where the presenter somehow thinks that if he gives you so many details you can't understand them, that you'll think that he's smart because he understands all these details and he can't communicate. And as far as I'm concerned, that person's might be smart in some ways, but is very dumb in other ways. That, you know, understanding your audience, you know, your goal when you're communicating is not to baffle people. They aren't going to think you're smart. The goal is to help them understand, and thinking about the level of understanding of who you're going to communicate with is really important. And I do spend time up front trying to do that.
Yep. Sometimes, you know, you mentioned that like the point of communication is not to baffle people, but sometimes I wonder with engineers if there might be a little bit of, you know, I've definitely seen some things in the past where it almost felt like something was designed to make someone look a little bit more intelligent, you know, or designed to be very, very difficult to explain to other people, maybe to like make someone themselves feel a little more, what's the word I'm looking for? A little more impressive for having figured it out or something like that. And I feel like that's, you know, really something that we should probably work against, you know, in communication nowadays. We want to try and make things as simple to understand as possible, because that's where you're going to have the most effect, not more difficult to understand just for the sake of, you know, sound making something sound more impressive.
Yeah, Jacob.
Understand that you aren't impressing people by going into all these minutiae that nobody else can understand. That, you know, yes, you know, all you're saying is you're smarter than everybody else, but, you know, it's not effective. And you just really need to figure out how to, it's not communication, it's, I don't know, aggrandizing or something.
Yeah, Jacob, you were telling me that in your academic life, you've been a teaching assistant sometimes, or maybe been like a leader of your peer group and so on. And what's your experience like in explaining technical concepts in a humble manner?
Yeah, it's interesting, because one thing that I've kind of turned into with my peers now I'm in graduate school now, a lot of people know about me. One thing that I actually did over the pandemic is I started like a big online forum for people at my school, specifically in electrical and computer engineering, to communicate, because we were taking a lot of the same classes and we didn't have that like network that we used to have in person. So I made something online for people to talk about that. And from there, a lot of people came to know me because I was the one running that forum. And because of that, nowadays, people come to me a lot for questions. We don't really use the forum much anymore because we're back in person. But people still know my name, and they know that I'm in those classes, so they'll come to me for questions. And, you know, you start to try to learn how to explain these things. Because the thing that's difficult in a school setting, you know, and is that you've just learned a concept, right? You learned it maybe a few minutes ago, and now you have to explain it to someone else and try to break down how is it that I understand this? What are the key pieces that make this concept concrete to me, and how can I transfer that to someone else?
Yeah, it's fun and challenging. One of the things I've found myself doing is using analogies with real life situations and trying to anthropomorphize the code or the microarchitecture or something and relate it to something that we already know. I realize that that's how my brain thinks and organizes information. And if it happens to be useful to someone else, well, that's their problem.
Yeah, I found that color especially has been very helpful when describing things to people in the past. Like, you know, I'll start with a verbal explanation, and if I feel like the verbal explanation isn't getting anywhere, then I'll move to paper or something like that, or maybe like a drawing tablet. And then using color to differentiate different things is also really helpful, or to draw out specific concepts or diagrams. I find that always is really useful.
It sounds like you have some basic leadership skills, which is really important. So it's not just what you can do yourself. It's also enabling others and setting up the way of communicating with your fellow graduate schools. You got potential, kid.
I mean, that's something that I value significantly is, you know, you mentioned earlier about how, like, when you're a manager, you're amplifying your impact, right? Because not only is it the work that you can do, but it's the work that everybody that you work with or work beneath you or even work around you can do. And that's something that I've taken with me my entire time that I've been in school is I'll always stop to help someone else because the little impact that I have on that person can be more than that. You know, like I put in a little bit of effort to explain something to someone, and now that helps them get one concept, and maybe they can take it the rest of the way, or maybe they can help now that they understand that concept, they can teach it to someone else, you know, and it's this resounding effect from there that ends up helping everyone. And to me, that's what's much more important than my own output is the output of everyone, you know, is that everyone is successful. Because if everyone's successful, well, that means we all have a better world to live in, right? You know, if everybody, it's very easy to kind of look at this as a competitive thing, especially in companies, right? Because we are literally competing with other companies. But at the end day, we want to make the best products, not just because of, you know, the financial impact that has on the company, but also because it just makes the world a better place, you know, because of the technologies that we help produce are creating more new and exciting opportunities for the future.
Absolutely. So there are competitors out there and we need to compete and, you know, give it our best shot. One of the things I love about Ampere is we're very much the whole organization, you know, over 1,000 people even, aligned. We all have the same mission. We're all trying to do the same thing. We help each other out. A lot of times, once you get beyond some size, and the size might even be, you know, 10 or 20, if you have two teams and they're fighting, if they're competing with each other and fighting each other and holding back knowledge and not sharing because they want to get ahead of the other, you know, that's just a disaster for a company. And I really like Ampere, our DNA, the effort that our executives are putting into having us all be aligned and a common mission and our values is really important. And Ampere is a very well-run company.
Yeah.
It's not always this nice.
Yeah. It's rare even for a startup. You know, I worked at a startup during grad school and there was just 10 people. And there's one guy who happened to be the founder who wanted to work on other projects than the one that everybody else was working on. that was trying to make revenue. And so there was a bifurcation just then in this, you know, 6-month-old startup where there's one faction doing something completely different. And that led to a lot of issues and consternation and problems. And eventually we had to let him go. We let go of the founder. And I learned a lot from that company and the failures of that company. And I totally agree with Kevin, is the longer that you can stay completely aligned and have 1,000, 2,000 people all facing the same direction and marching, you're going to make something really good and you're going to feel good about it.
Yeah, because it's just coming down to like healthy and unhealthy competition, right? Because you can have some healthy competition within a team, right? But you have to make sure that that competition is always productive and not reductive. And then from that, also, one thing that has really impressed me about hearing Renee speak about our competitors is she always speaks about them very cordially. And that's something that I respect a lot, because you hear a lot of CEOs of companies kind of take like a very, what's the word I'm looking for? A very aggressive approach when talking about their competitors. But hearing Renee, it's like, it almost feels like she has a great respect for our competitors. And I think that is a great way of having healthy competition, right? Because at the end of the day, it is competition because they're other companies, but we still respect them and we're still impressed with what their output. And you know what? It just drives us to work even harder.
Yeah. She knows how hard they had to work to get to where they are. And we have to work harder to get past them.
Well said.
So I think this is a good question for you, especially just because of how much experience you have working in computing, is what has it kind of been like seeing the landscape change over the course of your career, seeing the direction that the companies that you've worked in go in, seeing just the competition around you and just seeing like trends in the computing industry? Of those trends, do you have any that have been really impressed you or really intrigued you, and maybe some that have frustrated you?
I try really hard not to get frustrated. I kind of go with the flow and just look for fun things and opportunities. But, you know, I got to tell you, so when my first job in computing was working on a mainframe, the software for the mainframe, and the mainframe was actually something a bunch of different companies were renting time on. They were all running on the same machine. We only had one CPU, but it was, you know, time slicing and everything else. So it really was just what's happening in the cloud right now. You have this big computer somewhere and a bunch of companies running time on it. So we went from the mainframes to the mini computers to the personal computers, and but we're kind of back to where I started, the way I look at it. But everything along the way was interesting. Okay, and now we're just going to deal with these PCs. Let's make them go fast. But it really is, you know, the multi-tenant server that you're time-sharing with other people is kind of back in vogue again. And all throughout ages, they needed compilers and good architectures to run all of this.
Yeah. Speaking of being in vogue, when I was kind of coming out of grad school, and I'll be blunt, I did not take the compilers class. And the reason was because our little peer group was kind of sitting around talking about how compilers don't matter anymore. This was like in 2000. Well, no, we know how to generate code, right? But what fascinates me now, like looking back over the last 20 years in Kevin's field, right? The fundamentals matter a lot. People are thinking about how, you know, machine learning is changing everything, you know, multi-core processors, parallel programming, deep learning, and generative AI, and all these things are kind of new and flashy over the years. But like, if you look at the fundamentals of compiler technology, we have come across like Java in the late 90s and just-in-time compilation, and it kind of injects a brand new life into the compiler writers industry, right? And JavaScript comes along, and now JavaScript is all over your browser and basically running the internet with Python, which is also kind of loosely typed and has a just-in-time aspect to it. Android phones are all running on this technology, and you need people generating code for the virtual machines there. And new languages like Go language, Lua, LuaJIT, Julia, they all require people to generate code. And so if you have the fundamentals of how to do that, you still have a job. It's just amazing to see that. And yeah, like I kick myself for saying or thinking something like that, because a lot of what's old comes back again and becomes in vogue up and down the stack you go. And each one of those pieces is very important.
Yeah. So yeah, you had me worried there thinking that, compilers would go away. And, I never thought that. But if they did, if you really didn't need them, I'm pretty sure I'd find something else that was interesting and fun.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd say they're even more important these days because of the software stack has grown so much that there's so many different layers. And at each level of that full stack, there's some abstraction that's happening that's even more difficult to debug. And we need these full stack developers. And as you go up and down that stack, like, what kind of code are you generating? It matters a lot more now.
Yeah, and it's still fun.
Yeah,
it's still fun. I think that's more important than the, you have to be working on something that you enjoy, that you love. You have to be good at it. I mean, if you really suck at it, even though you love it, it's not going to do any good. And you need to be doing something that the organization needs. If you're doing something that's fun, that you love to do, but nobody cares, you either have to do something else or make them care.
So one thing I've, throughout this conversation that I've heard you talk a lot about, Kevin, is just how much you enjoy doing what you do, and that you love your job. I guess the first question I have on that aspect is, what if you had to kind of like psychoanalyze yourself just a little bit, what is it that you enjoy so much about what you do? Why do you find it so much fun?
It's a job where I get to solve puzzles all the time. The first thing I do when I wake up in the morning, so I'm kind of old school still. I get my newspaper delivered. In the morning, I go out in the driveway, I get it, I look at the front page, I see the headlines that I read on my phone the night before, and then I go to the Sudoku puzzle and solve that. That's my first thing in the morning, because I need a Sudoku before I can get going. I just love solving puzzles, and everything about my job, and just about anybody's job, is solving puzzles. How do I communicate to this other person? How do I make this program go faster? How do I motivate someone else that I need to work with? It's just, everything's a puzzle and you got to go solve them. And that's kind of fun. Maybe I just make everything into a puzzle. I don't know.
That's a good question.
Engineers do.
Yeah, because it's like, which one is it? Is it that everything in life is a puzzle, or is it that maybe you can just think of everything in life as a puzzle, and maybe that just changes the way that you perceive the challenges that you face? Because I think a lot of us, it's very easy to look at the things that we're faced with as challenges, but I think, the way that you say, when you think about it as a puzzle, as something that's fun and interesting that you get to do and you get to solve, that makes it much more approachable than as, this unsurmountable, difficult task where it's like, no, it's a puzzle. It's a difficult puzzle, but it's a puzzle and I'm going to find the solution, And I think that's a really, really healthy way to think about that.
And maybe that's what makes it fun. You're always learning, you're solving puzzles, and that's fun. Working on challenges, that doesn't seem as much fun.
So do you feel like for someone who's, joining the tech industry and is trying to find what they enjoy and what they find fulfilling, do you think that maybe a good way to phrase that is like, look for the puzzles that you enjoy?
Yeah, that's one way. It's your attitude also, right? Just, having the right positive attitude that makes it interesting for you. So yeah, for me, it was puzzles. Puzzles may not be the panacea for everyone else, but you know, it happens to work for me. And you need to find out what works for you that keeps you super engaged, always learning, and always adding value.
And that may change over time also.
Oh, yeah.
Spread your wings and realize like, oh, I really like compilers all of a sudden, and I want to understand more about the just-in-time aspect of code. And or maybe you've
okay, seen my, one or Mahesh, you want to work on Java?
Yeah.
It sounds like it.
Yeah.
What do you want to do, Jacob?
Oh, geez. Yeah, I mean, my biggest interest right now in my coursework is in computer architecture. And obviously that can go a lot of different ways. Right now, it looks like immediately probably verification, just because I'm taking a lot of classes on Verilog. I'm going to be taking some classes on System Verilog next semester, and I find that to be very interesting. You know, like taking code and making hardware out of that is very interesting. And then further on from that, like all of the topics that we've discussed about like trying to verify that something works, that when you actually print it on a design, and that you can verify not only that it works before you send it out, but also that you can verify that it works when it comes out of the factory and stuff like that. That does sound very interesting to me. And you know, like you talked about puzzle solving, there's a lot of elements of puzzle solving in that too, about like, you know, trying to optimize for performance over area or power consumption, or trying to verify like what test vectors can I use to verify that this circuit works the way it's supposed to, that this bit of logic works the way it's supposed to, you know. So that's probably my current interest.
Yeah, testing is a lot of fun, and sometimes doesn't get a fair shake because people think that, oh, you're not writing code, you're just testing someone else's code. But it's even more important to be able to verify, because you learn what other people are doing. You know, I know a lot of these coding interviews that people have are, you're trying to figure out how to write code. But I've seen now that a lot more companies are starting to do interviews based on like, how well can you read code? Right? There's enough software out there. The Linux kernel has millions of lines of code. How much of those do you know? It is less likely that you'll write more of them, and more likely that you're going to be reading them to understand how that software works in your system. The job of a verification engineer or a test engineer is I think harder, because you have to understand the entire software.
Well, it's true for developers too. There's very few times you're given a project that's totally from scratch. You're always modifying something that exists already. Yeah. So being able to read somebody else's code, understanding it, you know, if you just start doing things without understanding what you're working on, you're just going to make a mess of it. So yeah, I mean, for everyone, not just test engineers, but development, you've got to know how to fit into the existing framework, which means understanding it, learning how to quickly read it. You know, even on compilers, I've been involved in 5 different compilers over my career, and none of them were started from scratch.
Even the Intel compiler? I know you had a big hand in starting that group.
Yeah, that was derived from a multi-flow compiler.
Interesting. Yeah, so we're all standing on the shoulders of giants before us.
Yes.
Yeah, it's the biggest thing I've noticed with the engineers that I've worked with so far at Ampere, is it seems like the most defining characteristic of a good engineer is someone who can learn quickly. I mean, obviously your output is important too, but if you have to spend a really, really long time understanding something in the first place, it's going to take you longer to make something. So a lot of times it almost feels like most of your time as an engineer is spent understanding something, and then less of your time is actually spent implementing it, if that makes sense.
Oh yeah. And if you shortcut that process, you aren't going to be effective. If you don't really learn it before you try to do something, everyone's in a hurry to do something. But you know, even if some people learn more slowly than others, you do need to spend that time up front.
Uh-huh. Because obviously the ideal is that you learn something quickly and well, but sometimes it's hard to learn things quickly and well, you know, better to learn something slowly and well than quickly and not well.
Yeah. So Jacob, when you were going through the learning process over the past few months, how did your mentors impact you or help you along that way? How was your interaction with them?
That's a good question, because what's interesting about my internship is that I did have like a mentor, but it was less that I was working with one specific person and more that I was working with a lot of people. Like, I've worked directly with my manager a lot here recently. I've worked with different engineers in my firmware team. So more so, it's been the biggest thing that I've noticed is just trying to watch how they work and understand how they think through what they're doing. And some engineers are a little bit better about telling you what they're doing and why they're doing it. Especially my manager, he's really good at that. But other engineers, you know, they can struggle a little bit, you know, and they'll just kind of do something and then not really explain it. And sometimes you have to stop and be like, well, can you explain how you did that or why you did that? Or sometimes it's just as simple as really paying attention and seeing what they do and then trying to understand what they do as they do it. That's kind of been my experience so far. And that's one thing I really hope to do myself whenever I'm the one who has an intern, is trying my best to make sure that not only am I getting my own work done and so such, but I'm demonstrating every time I'm working with that intern why I'm doing the things I'm doing and how they can learn from that experience and use those, not only in the job that they're doing right now, but in any job, right? Because a lot of those skills are transferable.
Okay. So you would say even your learning process was collaborative in a way?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it always is. It's never going to be as simple as one person. It's their sole job to sit there and teach you how to do your job. You're always going to be learning from different people. And sometimes you're learning from people who just pass by you in the office for a bit to just talk about something. Or maybe you can get ideas from almost anything in your job. And some of that's less concrete, some of that's more concrete, but it's all, you know, sums together.
Yeah, it's funny. I know that in my career, when I've paid attention, I've learned a lot at many different levels.
It's, you know, it's just difficult because there's always a little bit of a budget of attention, right?
Exactly.
There's only so much attention you can pay, and you need to make sure that you're paying attention to the important things, right?
Yep.
Because your brain can't take in everything. You have to block out some stuff and really hone in on the things that are super important.
Yeah.
Yeah. And try to like realize when because sometimes nuggets of really important knowledge can just go by like nothing. You know, somebody can be telling you something basic while they're explaining an idea to you, and it's just like something very basic to them, but it's something very profound to you, you know. And learning to really pick up on those, I feel like, is a big part of technical communication.
Yeah. Yeah. And also the ability to say no. And I realized that I've reached the end of my knowledge, and I could go further, but I don't need to go further at this point because I don't need to know that right now.
Yeah, you do sometimes have to put on some blinders so you can stay focused and get something done.
Yeah, because if you're just always asking questions and always trying to understand everything, then you're going to be compromising the time that you could be spending really understanding what you need to understand better.
Yep.
There's a lot of distractions that are always popping up, and you have to recognize them as such.
Yeah, understanding which puzzles are distractions and which ones are, I guess, elegant enough. Keep your mind on and concentrate so that you get a product out the door and make revenue.
Yeah.
So talking, you know, more about these puzzles that you worked on, Kevin, and all of the projects you've done throughout your career, do you think you could maybe talk about some of the most exciting things you've worked on, maybe some of the most interesting puzzles that you've had to solve?
I would say that the more interesting ones were always in the communications area and not really in the technical ones. Communicating to upper management what I'm doing, why it's important, why it matters to them, and what the impact will be. That those were the most challenging puzzles, the hardest ones. And it was like, you know, technically, you know, it was all there. I could have talked forever and they wouldn't have understood a word I was saying. But talking about not what the technical thing is, but the impact, you know, it's like this whole meta conversation you have to have. And sometimes those are the hardest. And I must say that probably some of my biggest failures were not doing that well. And then, but you know, the more you do it and you learn from your mistakes and you go on and you get better at it, and, you know, just really figuring out who you want to communicate with and how best to do that is probably one of the toughest puzzles I've ever worked on.
Are you able to share any of those war stories, maybe in an anonymous fashion?
So in my previous life, I had a one-on-one with our current CEO, Renee, and I explained to her all of the things about a compiler. So what it was, how it works, why it matters, how we make ours better than everybody else's. And she was a quick learner. She really, you know, got it quickly. And that was important in at various times in her previous career. And fortunately for me, I convinced her that compilers were important. And when she started Ampere, she wanted compiler expertise. So it all kind of worked out. So Renee probably knows more about compilers than Mahesh does, because Mahesh refused to take the class.
That's right. Yep.
So Jacob, you can take a class in compilers?
You know, I really want to, but the end of my degree is coming up really fast. And it's one of like four or five classes that I just am not going to have time to take, unfortunately. But I really wish. I've talked to some people in the past who have taken the compilers class. You used the word magic earlier. It does kind of feel like magic, even when they try to explain it, you know?
Well, good for you. It sounds like you're able to focus on what needs to be done and get rid of interesting distractions. Keep them at bay.
Yep. Fair enough.
I will say that I think that compilers and microarchitecture kind of sit right there on the fence of hardware and software, like on opposite sides of that fence. And we work so closely with one another, and you can't do well in one without the other.
Absolutely. You know, if you're programming some JavaScript application that's, you know, making your phone screen do something really cool, you probably aren't thinking about registers and caches and instructions. But when you're working on a compiler, you're absolutely thinking about that.
I remember analyzing some JavaScript applications, and we had noticed how there was so many more checks for integer overflow. Because of the way that JavaScript is typed, at any given time, you may add two numbers and you have to check for overflow. And so there's like a specific flag that you set if you overflow, and you have to jump to a handler for that. And every single time you add two numbers in JavaScript, you have to check that because you don't know, right? And so one of the things that we were trying to figure out in the microarchitecture is, should we make that instruction faster, jump with overflow? And we showed that if we do that, then we can get some, you know, percentage performance improvement and on these tests. But it doesn't affect any other tests that you have in the world, right? So then, you know, we had to go to our management and try to convince them, should we do this or not? And that was a problem, like right there at the boundary of hardware and software.
I'm curious if that you used the word convince. It was that like something that you wanted to implement, or was that something that you were genuinely not sure if it should be implemented or not?
I thought it would have been a good idea just for the sake of improving your browser performance. I don't think that feature went in. I forget if it was a technical reason why, or if it was a you know, schedule or management reason why. Because if you try to make one thing faster, that requires a certain amount of area in your in your CPU, and maybe that flow is going to be different, and then you have to verify that. And do you want to take on that technical debt for generations to come just based on some engineer's pet project, right? So you have to kind of take a look at the whole picture there and figure out what you want to do.
Yeah, it's always trade-offs, especially when you're dealing with silicon. There's only so much silicon, right?
Yep.
Yeah, I always want bigger caches. And just give me bigger caches. And then
you're probably not going to get bigger caches.
Now, if you have a bigger cache, that means you have to snoop it more.
Oh, gosh.
So be careful what you wish for.
Okay, give me a bigger snoop filter.
All right. Well, you know, this is something that I've found personally is that like hobbies and creative outlets have been not only a good way to de-stress from that kind of work, but also honestly, I feel like improved the way that I think about technical problems by allowing me to come up with more creative solutions to those problems. And first of all, I'm kind of interested about if you have any like hobbies or interests outside of tech, and do you think that if any of those things have informed the way that you think about how you approach your job?
I tend to be pretty active doing things. I love to golf. I love to ski. And I run every day. And my running's kind of interesting. I think that's the one that helps the most. Because running's kind of boring. It's not like when you're skiing, you have to make sure you don't run into a tree and stuff. So running, you're just kind of going along. You know, you aren't going to run into a tree. And I find myself every now and then, I stop and I say, oh, I don't remember running the last mile. And it's because I'm just going along and my mind's just thinking about all sorts of things. And usually it's the puzzle that I'm currently working on at work. You know, I just, it's quiet time. I don't have my laptop. Don't have a whiteboard, but I'm just running and thinking about things. And I think I have come up with a lot of solutions during my running time.
Yeah, I've noticed myself doing the same thing on like drives to work or something like that, or to school, like thinking about a problem, especially school problems, because those structured problems, right? So you can come up with solutions with them a little bit faster. But I've definitely thought about that a lot. You know, when I'm doing something that doesn't use my mind that much, I can come up with solutions to problems.
It's amazing when you drive to work or you drive to school every day and one day you get there at the end and then you're like, wait a second, what just happened in the last 5 minutes? Who was the one driving here? You know, where did the mind go? There have been other guests on this podcast also that have said exactly this about running and how they when they go running, they don't use headphones or anything. They just let their mind attach on something else and use it as a meditative way to solve problems.
Yeah, no headphones for me.
Yep, I'm the same way.
Yeah, I think that's definitely something that not only is that a trait of a lot of engineers, I think it's just a trait of a lot of problem solvers in general. You know, like one thing that my father always used to talk about is he'd get very frustrated whenever he would have to stop working on a project. Because it's like, as soon as he starts working on something, he can't stop thinking about it until it's done. And I feel like I kind of inherited that from him. And I feel like I've experiencing that same kind of line of thinking in a lot of people, especially in engineering, but also really anything that's problem solving oriented. Because your brain doesn't stop when you walk away from the desk. It doesn't stop when you walk away from, in my dad's example, is usually something like carpentry or something like that. Your brain really only stops thinking about it once it's working, right?
Yeah, you know, I keep thinking about why I think my job is fun. And to put that into perspective, I've thought, well, what would it be like if it were not fun? And if my job weren't fun, then I wouldn't be thinking about it when I'm running. So obviously my job is fun because I'm thinking about it when I'm running.
Problem doesn't leave your head when you close your laptop.
Yeah. No. Unless your job's not fun.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you're doing everything you can to get it out of your head. So speaking on that, like coming up with solutions to problems when you're doing things unrelated, at least immediately to work, have there been Can you think of any concrete examples of a time that you were struggling to come up with a solution to a problem, and then maybe you had something, you know, in your everyday life that directly inspired a technical solution? Because I've definitely heard a few stories of people doing something and then, or seeing something, and then automatically that click, something clicks in their brain.
I hope that question for Mahesh, because I can't recall anything like that. I mean, it probably happened, but
that sometimes it's the type of thing that just completely goes out of your brain, or you don't even realize. Or, and some people, there are a lot of people who are very like, ooh, yeah, this one thing happened, and they tell that story about, you know, everything. Anytime they want to talk about like debugging war stories, or like, yeah, I saw this one thing, or I saw this something on TV, and then it made me think about this, you know. But not all of our brains work quite like that.
Yeah, storytelling is, I think, important, because as you share these things, it is the history of our industry, our very narrow industry of CPU design, and all the kind of all the roles that we all have around that. And as we share these stories, we learn from one another and tell the history of our generation, so that the next generation can learn and grow as well. So, I mean, that is one of the motivations for doing this podcast.
Yeah, there's so many people here who have done so many important things over the course of their career. You've just got so much history and so many stories, and just so much experience. It's hard to not want to tap into that as much as you can.
Yeah, I'm trying to think 10 years from now, what are the Ampere getting started stories that are going to be told?
Yeah, Renee actually pulled me aside once and said, she thanked me for doing this work, because it's a historicity of what's happening in the first few years. And, I thanked her for letting me do this. And she's like, why wouldn't I want an engineer telling our stories? So I feel very privileged to be able to do media, audio, and video for this company. It's just really cool. And I'm glad to have you guys join me in this journey. So thank you for that.
Hey, wouldn't it be great if 10 years from now, people are still listening to this podcast?
Yeah. Hello, people in 2033. Hello.
Someone will.
Yeah.
And if anything, it'll always be there as a place for us to reminisce, you know, on this time.
Yeah.
Maybe to hear ourselves talk about, you know, oh, I remember doing this podcast like 5-10 years ago. Let me see if that's still there. What did I sound like? How, you know, how much does my brain change since then? How am I, you know, probably a little bit of like embarrassment or something like that about something you said in the past. Like, oh man, I don't think that way at all anymore. But, you know, it's a nice time capsule into this age of the company.
Yep.
I think the only question that's left on my sheet that we haven't really covered either, you know, literally or just through our conversations is just like, Kevin, very frankly, do you have any final advice for new college graduates about to enter into the industry?
I don't think it's new, but I'll just kind of summarize what I said. You know, find something that you love to do. Make sure you're good at doing it. And then make sure that it's filling a need for your organization. And keeping those three things aligned are what's really important.
I had one question that I'd like to pose at Kevin. You've had quite an outstanding career and impacted many people. And I know that you also have a great family life, and you were able to balance all of these things in your life and your hobbies and your running and so forth. How do you do it? How do you have it all? How are you able to be successful?
Well, my wife always says I should spend a little bit more time at home, but you know, it's what I try to do with everyone that I'm interacting with a lot is making them feel important. So even if there's maybe not as much time, making sure that they feel special and valued and important. I have four daughters. I have four grandkids, about to be six grandkids, and they love their grandpa because I make them, I do what they want to do, and my daughters, they're very important to me, and I let them know it. And my wife, she's very important also, and I let her know it. I love all of them, and making sure that their specialness to me, they know. So, but the actual balance, that's hard.
Yeah. Because it's difficult to make everyone in your life feel like they're important when you've only got so much time to distribute amongst them, right?
Yeah, but it's important to make them feel important.
Right, you just got to do what you can,
Yeah. Very good. So it looks like we've reached the end of our time here. So I want to thank Jacob and Kevin. Thank you, Jacob Little. Jacob is a grad student at the North Carolina State University, where he's studying computer engineering and graduating very soon, and we're going to hope that he comes back to Ampere. And thanks to Kevin Smith, Senior Director of Compiler Technology at Ampere, and one of my mentors. I've learned a lot from you, and I hope to continue doing so for a long time. Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you. It was great.
Awesome.
Yeah, this was a great experience.
Cool. Yeah, I'm also glad that we're able to do this kind of thing, and your participation is like pushing us out to like episode 32 or 33 or something like that. And when we started, I didn't think that we were going to get this far, but it has this ball is rolling, and I hope to continue doing this.
Well, you're doing a good job, and I hope Ampere's are listening to it in 10 years.
So yeah, goodbye everyone from 2023. We'll see you again.